This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Departments and centers of women's studies are fairly common today at the Academy. Thankfully, there are places where women's thought and women's lives are being documented, but it wasn't always that way. These programs have been with us for only the past several decades, and many of the pioneers of women's studies are still with us and still working hard. Jean Fox O'Barr helped found Duke University's Women's Studies Department in 1983. She later went on to co-found the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture. Jean Fox O'Barr joins our program today to talk about exactly what got her there. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Well, tell us how you got there. You grew up in Chicago in northern Indiana. It was a particularly conservative family, I understand.
It was a conservative family, but not in today's terms. Conservative in fiscal terms, probably, but fairly culturally and civically aware. My parents were very civically aware, and they were certainly can-do people. They thought that problems could be solved. If there was an issue, you could solve it.
You, but you as an individual, kind of a bootstraps sort of conservatism or no?
I think that was probably mitigated in many ways by my involvement with the Congregational Church at that stage in my own life and a maternal grandfather who didn't buy any of this. He was an Emerson reader and a poet and an artist. And so he was one kind of influence. And my paternal grandfather, on the other hand, was another influence. I remember very clearly my enthusiasm for Girl Scouts and his lack of enthusiasm for the global perspective of Girl Scouts. And he called me into his office one day and he told me that he had learned I shouldn't read certain pages in my Girl Scout handbook. And I had no idea what he was talking about. But I learned later that the John Birch Society had published a number of materials criticizing the globalism of Girl Scouts.
And
that was bad.
Right. But this is the theory that he becomes aware of and
yes,
that needs to warn you about.
Warns me. And I paid apparently no attention because I continued to love and do Girl Scouts and be interested in the world at large.
You had a series of surgeries as a young person.
I did. I was born with quite a bit of disfigurement from a mole on my lower left leg, and I had a series of surgeries. And then just to cap it off, my junior year in college, I was in a near-fatal automobile accident in Spain where that leg was broken. And so I've had a lot of orthopedic surgeries throughout my days.
Did that have any impact on you, a concept of pain, your physicality?
My parents were very good about this is the situation, so let's get on with it. And I learned to organize and figure out how to get things done, which sort of had come also from my family. But I had always been a reader, so that gives you more opportunity to read when you're laid up. That's good. And I think it taught me to be very sympathetic to people with other difficulties, whatever the nature of those difficulties. We all carry something that's harder for us than somebody else.
Your sister had difficulties of a different sort. Tell
right.
us about your relationship with her and where both of you kind of fit in the family as a result.
Well, I was the oldest. We have a middle sister. And my younger sister, who died 3 years ago, had many more if you will, psychological issues that were hard to deal with. And those kinds of issues are not resolved by just saying get up and do or let's get on with it or organize our way out of things. So I've always been sympathetic. And in high school, I worked with the handicapped children's classroom after school. And, well, they had a separate school at that point. They weren't mainstreamed. But anyway, I've always had a degree of sympathy for people with other difficulties.
So you're a Girl Scout. You're kind of a can-do gal. You're exhibiting a great deal of compassion early on. Your grandfather was concerned. This was the paternal grandfather who gave you the warning. What about your political sensibilities? When did they start coming alive?
I don't think they started to come alive until I got to college in particular, and most especially during my year at the University of Edinburgh. There I was. I didn't go on a program. I had relatives. I had been to Edinburgh to visit my great-grandmother when I was 10, and I went back for my junior year of college and lived with some distant relatives. And the University of Edinburgh was filled with young men from Africa learning how, if you will, to lead their countries. They were fascinating people. And as anybody who's been a student abroad knows, all the foreign students get lumped together. It doesn't matter where you come from. And I was fascinated with these. I don't remember any women amongst them. They were all men, but they were all talking about the future of their countries. This is 1963.
So this is exactly on the threshold of independence.
Absolutely, on the threshold of independence. And I came back then to Indiana University, where I was a student in my senior year, albeit on crutches, but fascinated with the study of Africa, and so started immediately to take African history, African politics, et cetera.
And that took you back to Tanzania.
That took me back to Tanzania. When I went to graduate school, I met and married a fellow graduate student, and we decided on Tanzania as the place. He was an anthropologist and wanted to work in a local area, and I wanted to buck the trend that I saw amongst my other graduate student cohort. I wanted to study the politics of these new nations, as they were then called. This is very old language. The new nations from the bottom up. How was the message being received rather than what the central government was saying from the center? Everybody else I knew was studying in the capital. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go into the countryside.
Well, this is revolutionary. I mean, in a way, the idea that what it is that people are actually thinking. This is, first of all, hard to document, right? Which is kind of why they stay at the Capitol, because there's newspapers and official documents we can read.
Yes.
You're looking at and particularly in places where perhaps literacy is not very high. You don't even have diaries or journals or letters.
No. We only have people talking and meeting and thinking about things. But we used a technique that the British system had used, which was to run an essay contest for the children as one way of meeting people and getting them to talk about what this new nation meant to them. And that was a way to break into the community, because we had been trained to be participant observers, meaning we were supposed to just hang around and do what other people did. And then as you got to know them, do more systematic interviewing and recording of daily life and, from my point of view, what they were thinking politically.
Were you thinking about women's politics, women in politics, anything we might call feminism at the time?
Nope. But we did a comparative study of two villages. And in one village, there were no women in these local-level political roles. Tanzania, under Julius Nyerere, had set up a system of local government not unlike the panchayats in India, not unlike what the communist Chinese were trying to do in factories, small groups of people who would receive information. So this was an agrarian community, so they were by village, by household. And in the council, the first council that I went to, there were no women. There were women in political offices there. And in the second place I went, there were none. So the question for me, I got really interested then in the role of women in politics, because I had to explain this 25% variance.
Though there are some hints early on, things that are happening. When you were a senior in high school, you talk about, and I love this story, careers in dust as you're babysitting at a house across the street, the career woman in your neighborhood. Tell us
right.
That story.
Oh, Mary Lou Howie. Her son, Brian, actually works for one of the public television stations in Indiana. But I knew him when he was two. I babysat the summer I was 13, and Mrs. Howie, or Mary Lou Howie, was the only woman on our street on the two sides who went out to work. And she had been a journalism student, and so she became the women's editor. I think she worked 2 or 3 days a week, some portion, and her husband, Jack, was the city editor. And so I was babysat the two children, Lisa and Brian, and they were something like 4 and 2. And I would put them down for a nap so that I could quickly read as many books as possible. And, of course, they were young, so they slept and it was summer. And when I would lie down on the couch, I was fascinated with the fact that Mrs. Howie had enormous amounts of dust under all the bookcases in her living room. And none of the other houses in the neighborhood had dust. Oh, they didn't have many bookcases, but they certainly didn't have dust under the furniture. And Mrs. Howie apparently vacuumed or mopped, as the case may be, in front of those things. And I just thought that was a fascinating thing, because she was liked by the other women in the neighborhood, admired and never criticized that in that way. But I thought it was very interesting that it began to sort of form this idea that not all women or mothers in Indiana in the 1950s are just the same.
And respectability can come in many forms include a career.
And include dust along with that career.
Well, we'll talk about another foreshadowing. We'll take a little break, but there's another foreshadowing of your feminist career in 1965 when you have a choice to make. Your husband is sent to Europe or has an opportunity to study in Europe. You had a chance to study in Ghana. We'll talk about how that turned out. When our conversation with Jean Fox O'Barr continues, she's founding director of Duke University's Women's Studies Department and co-founder of the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with Jean Fox O'Barr, founding director of Duke University's Women's Studies Department, co-founder of the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture. And before the break, we were talking about your husband, who was we're both cultural anthropologists at the time. You are studying in Tanzania. He has an opportunity to study in Europe. You had a fellowship to Ghana. Tell us that story and how that turned out.
I'll make one correction. I was a political scientist. That's all right. We were in an interdisciplinary African studies program, but I don't want anybody to get confused on that one. Anyway, he had a chance to go with his major professor to an institute, and I was invited to go along with one of the study groups to Ghana for I can't even remember the length of time. But I was just that year married, and it was 65. And it never occurred to me that I could just go on my own. As a married woman, I think I was supposed to stay home, and I guess everybody else thought so too. I spent the summer in the Africana Studies Library at Northwestern. And I was I was miserable, not just because of the library, but because it seemed like a passed up opportunity. It never occurred to me. And no one ever said, well, you know, you could go.
Mm-hmm. And that's 1965. I mean, this gives us a sense of perspective, right, just how much things have changed. Though there was a moment of rebellion in the immediate aftermath.
Yes, there was. I watched the car pull out of the garage, and I went into the bathroom, and I said, I am going to pierce my ears, and I did it myself.
Now you would have pierced his ears.
Yes,
how things have changed.
I could have gone to the mall, but in those days you didn't go to the mall.
Well, imagine if you'd gone 1965, Kwame Nkrumah is still president and prime minister. The next year he would be overthrown by a coup d'etat. He's a man who believes in Pan-Africanism and who had a great vision for his country. The CIA helped overthrow him in a military coup. It's precisely these things you were talking about, these sort of collaborative ways of envisioning a country and working together that seem to be the most threatening to the power structures that were in place at the time, these patriarchies that had created our Western world.
Absolutely. And the focus in those days was very much more on West Africa. Partly we didn't go to study in West Africa because languages in West Africa are much more difficult. They're usually tonal languages. They're harder to acquire. The man who was my husband then certainly had greater language abilities than I did. But I got along fine in Swahili, which is easier and spoken in East Africa. And anyway, I ever since my years at Edinburgh, had been a follower of Nyerere. I was just interested in his experiment. So I wanted to go there.
So tell us what about your experience. You were one of the few white people in the village where you stayed. Is that right?
No, the whole mountain range. That was it.
Wow.
this is 1967 now. It's very different now. And my goodness, there are all sorts of things, including the Duke has a assembly at Arusha, which is the second nearest big town. But up on the mountainside, there were no other Europeans. We were it. And they called us, of course, Mzungu or Europeans, not differentiating between Americans and Europeans. We were white people. And we got all sorts of bizarre questions. There was no ability to understand if we were married, why we didn't have children. And that led to an awful lot of discussions about essentially family planning and ultimately contacting the Planned Parenthood people that were in the Capitol and bringing them up and helping the clinic move in that direction. So we got a lot of questions about how can you be married and not have children. At that time, I had long blonde hair and people couldn't understand what was on my head. They thought it was the plant that was grown all over there. They thought I had a sisal wig as opposed to having real hair. So we were curiosities, to say the least. But over time, we came to know people and accomplish our work, and I think made friends.
What was your work? You talked about trying to figure out how things were being received. What were you learning? What did you find out?
I found that the messages from the center about identity to this new unit, the nation, as opposed to the tribe or even smaller kinship groups, was very hard to have people switch. So a lot of indigenous leaders needed to be brought in to legitimize the transition. I found people very aware of the larger world, and they were willing to and interested in, but uncomprehending about what all of this might mean. They were interested in the economic benefits, and there was certainly a very strong feeling of nationalism or anti-colonialism, but the mechanics of it would be beyond, and the levels of education were very low. On the other hand, there were organizations and people working hard at explaining these transitions.
I think this is something that Westerners and Americans have a hard time understanding today when they see ethnic violence, we might call it tribal violence, in the elections. Mm-hmm. Try to get your head around it. But it's important to understand, as you're saying, that those tribal configurations had to remain together, that in order for there to be a national government, right, mm-hmm. the prime minister, the presidents, the governments had to recognize those things and keep them intact in a way.
Right.
Then as they become political entities and evolve, it's very hard to dismantle that and become something else.
But it's also important not to use the tribal units as the British did, which was largely as a source of revenue, but in a respectful way. And mm-hmm. I sat in hundreds of local council meetings with these male representatives debating how they would do something and what it meant. And there would be the political organizer would explain to them, we are going to, I don't know, clear a road, hold a rally, do this or that. And they would then ask thousands of questions about how we were going to do this. Were you going to recruit people by their indigenous loyalties or the new? And it was just the real nitty gritty was fascinating to me.
What role did women play in that decision making process?
The women played a large role in the sense that they could tap into female networks for making things happen. Whereas in the areas where women weren't in those positions, they couldn't tap into getting time, the energy, the resources, exactly like political organizing exists in this country right now.
So you leave Tanzania and you came. Did you come directly to Duke and Durham?
No, we went home to Northwestern to write our dissertations. And, of course, while we were gone, Martin Luther King had been assassinated. Robert Kennedy had been assassinated. And the world, American world, looked very, very different in 1969 from the way it looked when we left in 1967. Mm-hmm. So Northwestern looked different, but very quickly my husband was recruited to Duke and I came along in April of 1969. And as the exhibit that's up at Duke shows you right now, the Allen Building had been occupied by the students in February of 69, and the chair of the political science department received me, a very courtly man. And he explained to me that they didn't hire women, so there wouldn't be a position for me.
1969. Mm-hmm. We're not hiring. And I suppose he didn't even have to blush, right?
No, he didn't even have to explain. What he said.
Right. What was the political climate apart from that? Certainly not open to anything that we might call feminism. In fact, feminism really not in play. Was it in currency at the time?
Well, there were certainly student groups at Duke who were very aware of these things and had been helpful in the integration of Duke 5 years earlier. And there were certainly student groups interested in this. But at an administrative level, these are the years between 68 and 72 that the Women's College and Trinity College are being merged. So when I first came in 69, the chair of the political science department could say that without any reflective notion about women or women as students, et cetera.
Yeah, because there was a separate college, right. which is the kind of paradoxical history. I mean, the fact that there was a women's college goes back to 24 and James Duke's, a charge and creation of this mm-hmm. or transformation.
Right.
That was a progressive notion at the time.
Yes, it was. Yes, absolutely. But by 69, the students looked at it differently. But yeah. So did then, not he, but the man who replaced him. Because a number of faculty members in political science, what we could say quit, or we could say we're asked to leave, or we could say somehow we're no longer there when it came time to teach courses in the fall. So I got asked on very short notice. My oldest daughter was just a month old. But somehow I found a babysitter and trotted off to teach the African politics class. And then in January of that year, I had moved, and I had a daughter, and I had taught a class, and I'd finished my dissertation. And all of a sudden, I didn't really know what I was going to do. So at that point, or some parts in those months, I had met Anne Fearer Scott, who was one of the first women on the faculty at Duke. And she thought this shouldn't be. So she found a position for me at Chapel Hill in the political science department where her husband taught. And I taught both with him and some independently for 2 years.
Well, there is a name that's important to
yep.
The history of women's studies. And,
right.
You know, when we get back to your research in Tanzania, what are the people thinking about this from the top down? She was the pioneer in that for women's studies, who went back and found letters and journals that gave voice to.
Absolutely. She was an incredible pioneer in her own scholarship and also in the way in which she helped other women move. And I will always be grateful to her for opening those doors to me.
So when did it occur to you that women's studies was something that you should become involved in?
Well, that comes a little bit later. In 72, I came to the last year of the Women's College. I joined the staff in order to direct the continuing education program. That was the one thing that they had created that they wanted to last in the merger. And in those days, that was an opportunity for women to finish their baccalaureate degrees or get ready to take master's degrees, because the levels of women going to college weren't as high as they are now. Anyway, I was the acting and then the director of women's studies. And I'll never forget one woman from Chapel Hill who was taking courses in order to apply to the physician's assistant program. She had to do science. But she was also taking, I can't remember what else she was taking, but that was many. And she told me, she said she wanted to tell me something. I asked her how she was doing. She said, well, it was very difficult, but she was managing and she had figured out a really important tool for her. And I said, and what was that? And she said, I don't think I should probably confess. And I said, well, what is it? And she said, I read Virginia Woolf. And I said, oh. And she said, I know it's not literature, because of course at Duke in 1972, Virginia Woolf was not taught as literature. But she said, I find it very sustaining. And that was the first time that I had thought as quite as directly. I mean, I had written about the absence of women in political roles, but about the overall curriculum. And mm-hmm. I thought, if she's finding Virginia Woolf helpful, I wonder what there is else in literature.
Right.
And I obviously don't have a PhD in literature, but I began to get more and more interested in the interdisciplinarity. And, of course, women's history was blossoming, and I knew Anne. So these things were all kind of coming together. So I would say I began to understand the field of women's studies. And the first courses, there was an interdisciplinary women's studies course that I participated in. It was a lecture series where you just grabbed everybody that you could find and had them talk about women in their field.
Mm-hmm.
And I participated in that.
Okay, kind of like Career Day in high school.
Yes, exactly like Career Day in high school. I mean, we used to fill Gross Kim, 350, however many seats it was.
There you go.
But it wasn't a sustained look.
Yeah.
Very quickly, by the mid-70s, the founding of the journals in women's studies come in 1975. So that's the beginning of a more systematic look at the field.
It must have occurred to you, too, if this woman found the writing of Virginia Woolf sustaining and it's not in the curriculum, maybe that's not a coincidence.
Yes, right.
Right?
Yes.
And you write about that. I mean, about the importance of literature, what it is, what constitutes greatness in literature.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And that's an important – if we ask why feminism, why should we take this point of view, then seeing all of our studies, including the study of literature in that way, and what has been left out and why – is a very important one. So talk
absolutely
about that.
Absolutely. It isn't just what gets left out, but why it gets left out and what the consequences of it being left out are. So that woman, whose name I certainly can no longer recall, was kind of an opening door to saying, how do people identify with figures in literature? What literature? Who's writing the literature? And what questions do we ask of the literature written by either men or women? I mean, academic feminism is about question asking, not just adding a woman author, but asking questions about how gender is constructed or what it means, in addition to adding women figures to things. It's about the questions and then what you do with the comparisons. You can add women and say they're always, in some negative sense, not as good as men, but art history is probably the easiest example that people can use. But literature, as I suppose, as well, the whole question of what constitutes art. Well, craft is art, and
right.
miniaturization is art, and quilt is art, and letters are literature, and journals are literature. And those ideas seem very commonplace now, but in the mid-70s, they were not.
Well, your comparison of that you've done in the past of Nathaniel Hawthorne and Susan Warner, for instance, is mm-hmm. a way to say, why? How did we come to this standard and norm of what is good literature? Then how does Susan Warner not compare? How is it that your friend was able to say, well, I know Virginia Woolf is not literature? Where did that come from?
Well,
so maybe you could do that. Do that comparison for us.
She said it because her professors said it wasn't literature. And the Hawthorne-Warner example is often used by those of us, again, who aren't in literature. But that was first pointed out to me by Jane Tompkins, who was in our literature department. And the popularity of Susan Warner's work in her time and why the elite critics, if you will, and the gatekeepers of, if you will, of the academy decide what will be taught,
right.
Which reflects their own backgrounds and interests.
And for those of you out there like me who are not aware of Susan Warner, don't feel bad. She's not in the curriculum.
No.
Nathaniel Hawthorne was taught in high school. We didn't have Susan Warner. But tell us about her and the kind of writing that she did, how it compared to his, and why, if I'm writing the rules, I might have left her out.
Well, she dealt with more directly with women's lives. She dealt much more with emotion, if you will, in a very direct sense. It's been a long time since I've looked at her, but she didn't fit the more standard canon of things, and she wasn't able to be used, for example, like Uncle Tom's Cabin was, for a political statement. So she did her subject and her approach and probably her links to the literary establishment. I can't answer that question, but Hawthorne was tied into the literary elite of his time, and I suspect she wasn't. So for all those reasons, she gets left out.
And those kind of stories then aren't valued. So the idea of the networks that you create, the relationships that you have, are by definition less important because those kinds of stories don't get retained.
Right. Right.
In the literature, and stories of heroism and adventure do, and that's what we value. So then this comes home to you when your daughter quizzes you about the 1960s, has
right.
to do an assignment. Tell us that story.
Oh, well, she had an assignment to talk to events of the 1960s or something like that. So she interviewed me, and so I talked about the beginnings of feminism. I talked about the availability of birth control pills starting in 1960s. And I obviously talked about the first public aspect of the women's movement in 1968 at the Miss America parade. And she dutifully wrote it down. And when she turned her paper in, she was the only one who didn't talk about civil rights, Vietnam, and Woodstock or drugs or whatever else. And it was just like two different universes. Yeah. And the point was, of course, that all of those things occurred and they are related to one another and they inform one another. But at I had a view of what it was important to infuse, and she had a more standard approach to what the events were.
Mom, were you even there?
There, right. No, I must have missed the whole thing.
Jean Fox O'Barr was there. She didn't miss any of it, and she has brought forward her knowledge and shares it with the rest of us as the founding director of Duke University's Women's Studies Department, co-founder of the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture, also the author of Transforming Knowledge, Public Talks on Women's Studies. Our public talk on that very subject will continue on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Jean Fox O'Barr, founding director of Duke's Women's Studies Department, co-founder of the Sally Bingham Center, and has written a book, the author of Transforming Knowledge, Public Talks on Women's Studies. Tell us about founding the Women's Studies program. This is in the very early days of these programs.
Well, not so early. The first ones were founded in 1968, and we were offering courses because that was their in departments. That was their academic specialty. But when Ernestine Friedel came to be the first dean of arts and sciences at Duke, which I think was 80 or 81, something like that, she came from New York, where every school had a women's studies program. And so she very quickly constituted a committee and said, "Why don't we have one?" And they said we should have one, and she invited me for the fall of 83 to be the director. So Duke was actually a little bit later, but the field had was beginning to consolidate. There were journals and associations and et cetera. And so it was a matter of gathering the faculty who had interests in this subject, finding the resources to teach the introductory course, which brought these things together, and coming up, we started with a minor or a certificate in Duke language and eventually got to a major in 1986. But it was the people who were enthusiastic about it were enthusiastic, and the people who thought it wasn't important continued to think it wasn't important, and lots of people continued just not to think about it. I think some people I think were probably partially afraid of it. I tell in the book a story about Eleanor Smeal, who is one of the founding mothers of the women's movement and whose papers will be coming to Duke soon. Eleanor Smeal had been named in the 1980s as one of the leading figures in American politics, and I had convinced President Sanford to give a reception for her, and that all went well. And then a few years later, I started the process of nominating her for an honorary degree. That's a long, tedious process. You have to convince a lot of different people at a lot of different levels that this is a good idea. And so it was finally approved, and she was to get an honorary degree in 1991. And my last act was to write three words that would appear in the graduation program. So I wrote them. Then I got a call from the secretary of the administration, and I was told that we could not use the word feminist in the graduate program. It's 1991. And we talked and we talked and we talked and we talked, and we finally came up with the phrase, woman's advocate.
Wow.
And I had to settle for that because I didn't have a choice, but I was not happy. And I shared my unhappiness with a number of the students. And they looked into the question of, had anyone ever gotten an honorary degree at Duke for advocating on behalf of women? And the answer to that was no. And then they did the statistics, which they painted on a large bedsheet of mine and held up at the 91 graduation, that never had a black woman gotten an honorary degree as of 91. The black men had gotten 1.5 of the honorary degrees, white women 6.25, and white men 92.5 of the degrees. So they held this up. It was a bit disturbing. But I have a wonderful picture that a father of one of the students who was holding up the sheet took. Anyway, so there were all sorts of reactions to the founding of women's studies, and that's changed dramatically. Right now, women's studies is looked at these 20 years later, 30 years later, as the leading interdisciplinary study and is used as a model for many other interdisciplinary things. So the field has flourished.
So do you think the word feminist would be stricken from the program today?
People don't – the word feminist carries a lot of baggage with it. And there are many other newer words. People talk about gender. People talk about sexuality. People talk about the multi-constitutive or the multiple ways in each one of us shares identity. But feminism as a political strategy is there. People often will not use the word, whether it's within the academy or not. I used to try to teach students to think about the difference between being a strong individual and a strong individual who was willing to work on behalf of others in their group, be that race, sexuality, gender, disability, whatever. Because I think for me, feminism represents an awareness of your own strength, at the same time, the necessity of collaboration to change the status of a group.
And I think there is right there our distinction, one of the key distinctions that we should probably try to make. When a group of people suffers a kind of indignity as a group, there's a need to collectively act. And right. Then when that group is women, then you act as women. Does that mean that there's something essential about women that distinguishes them from men that means they're not universal?
No, I don't go down the essentialist line. I think we're all socially constructed, and we're all in socially constructed spaces, and the task is to see how that construction has made us and made the situation, and then ask, does it need to be changed so that the benefits of being in it, or the lack of benefits, whichever you look at it, comes equally to everybody. And that's, I think, where collaboration is very important, because any one person's perspective is by necessity limited, no matter how hard we all try. So I think my career has been, if you will, characterized by collaboration, because I'm always trying to bring more people in and see how we can look at this together.
That's part of the answer, though, to the question why mm-hmm. women's studies. I mean, you've talked about this and used the metaphor or the analogy of a single spotlight on a dancer.
Mm-hmm. The idea that a single spotlight only lets you see certain things. Multiple lights and more complex lighting allows you to see and to look at many more. And you can't turn on all the light switches by yourself. You need, if not many light switch turners on, you need at least a lot of people to help you program the new boards that would allow you to turn them all on. So it's a collaborative effort.
So tell us about this. What else women's studies, by using this point of view, this frame of reference to answer questions or examine the problems that we think are important today, what is it that women's studies brings? What's that perspective, and how is it different from others? What does it add?
I think it's a whole perspective. That is to say, you can't say that you're studying history or geography or politics or sociology or whatever if you don't ask questions about various identities, of which gender is a major one. And so I think women's studies brings wholeness to any academic enterprise.
And as you said, it is now perceived as the kind of center of interdisciplinary study. That's probably right. Not an accident, is it?
No, I mean it, because it draws on – women's studies is always drawing on the work of various disciplines at the same time that it's trying to create its own institutional space and faculty and classes in order to look at the nexus there. So it's both and. It's not something that's done in the departments or disciplines, nor is it something done exclusively in those places, but it's a very vibrant interchange between the two.
And I think it's important to see that it doesn't just add the voice of women and remind us that or tell us about things we didn't know that women did, but when you add those diaries and those journals and those voices that have been left out of history, your understanding of all of history
exactly.
changes.
So
right?
the social any field becomes richer if you can give it in corporate parlance. When you're talking about HR, people are always talking about 360s. It's a 360. You get to look all the way around and see how this affects everybody, not just women.
Tell us about the Sally Bingham Center now mm-hmm. and sort of the goals of the center.
The Sally Bingham Center is a division of the new Rubenstein if you will, center within Perkins Library. And that means that Duke is very famous for collecting primary documents, not books or newspapers, things that people have otherwise written, but the primary documents, the papers, the files, the letters, all sorts of things that give us information about how the world works or is constructed from the point of view of the people who constructed it. And so perhaps the most famous story that I remember is of at the Sally Bingham. Well, no, let me start backwards. Let me start back. Sally Bingham is a individual who was very concerned that women's papers were not being sufficiently collected. And so she made a series of initial gifts that allowed Duke to specialize in the collection of women's papers of every sort. There's artistic women, psychologists. We have the largest collection of papers on women's health, as well as political activism. So the Sally Bingham Center is the repository for collecting it and doing something else, which is sharing it, having public events where the scholars that are doing that work tell us what they're doing. In addition, and of course, it's what the faculty and students use as resources for their own research.
In fact, you had, an experience where a student picked up a pamphlet in the library and it gave you an insight.
Yes, we were in one of Duke's fancier rooms, the Gothic Reading Room, which is a very ornate Victorian parlor. And the archivist had put out primary documents with a little quiz sheet. Each student took a document and had to answer questions like, who wrote this and why did they write it and what do you think it means? And one young student, a first-year student, picked up a How to Give Yourself an Abortion, written by the Durham YMCA sometime in the 60s, mimeographed, of course, in sort of pale pink cover. And she could not simply believe that something like this should be or could be or was in the library. And so it was a wonderful discussion about why we needed to have that, not to advocate it, but to explain prior to Roe v. Wade that this was one of the ways in which people handled family planning. And it was a wonderful experience for her.
You, in Transforming Knowledge, you tackle the question, why not men's studies? Why don't we, as poor white men,
yes,
nobody ever talks about us.
Yeah, well, you're not named, but you're talked about. The curriculum is about the majority. Those who win get to write. And so the women's studies is about telling the whole story.
What is it, what is men's place, do you think, in women's studies?
I think it's a very active place. I have many – I certainly had the privilege of working with many male scholars and still do and have male students who are teaching women's studies and active. Academic work can be done by anybody. Your personal situation often leads you to ask questions that somebody else might not, but there's no reason that men cannot participate and do not participate as fully.
And of course, when we're talking about these very important questions that are asked and investigated in women's studies, it's not just academic. It changes my life. It changes my sense of privilege, who I am, what all of my assumptions can really be overturned if I get too deeply. And I mean, that gets to this fundamental question of the personal and the political, what's private and what's public space, and who got to define that in the first place.
Exactly. And I think women's studies, I think that's why I mentioned earlier this notion of wholeness. It isn't just wholeness about the whole of the curriculum or the whole of the historic or political study, but it's about wholeness in your own lives. If you're reading all of this and thinking about this and investigating it, then it has an impact on how you behave in the world, in your family, in your community, in wherever you travel. So the personal is political. There's no question about that. And it has always been political. It's just that with feminism, we sort of said it out loud and acknowledged it in ways that it hadn't been acknowledged before.
Which may be why you met so much resistance and perhaps still do today to some extent.
I think that there's still some resistance, certainly the resistance now is that this is over. But if you've been reading the New York Times recently about the story of gender and class at Harvard in that long series that's been going on, it is by no means over. It is better, but it isn't over.
If you reflect back on your early days studying those incipient African democracies and what was happening in those countries, first of all, how they got into that position, colonialism, and then look at your career in feminism and women's studies, do you see all of these things working together politically?
Yeah, I didn't set out to connect them, but in a reflective or looking backward kind of way, I clearly see that my interest in local level politics in Tanzania is not very much different from the politics of working with departments and working with students at the individual level. How is it that we are going to take in new information, transform institutions so that they are a more equitable place for everybody that's in them?
Well, now you're looking back. You retired, and I wonder what thoughts you have looking forward, going forward for the women's studies and women's movement, if there is one.
Oh, I think that there is there's still a women's movement. It looks very different from its more public phases, but I think the very amount of energy that's gone into a lot of the attempts to buck some of the political trends is often fueled by women at the moment, and I think women are very active in their workplaces and family places, informed by all of this. But it still needs to be taught and talked about and understood.
Jean, what a pleasure. Always great to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Jean Fox O'Barr, founding director of Duke University's Women's Studies Department, co-founder of the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture, and author of Transforming Knowledge, Public Talks on Women's Studies. If you want to find out more about this program or others, our website is stateofthings.org. It's a program produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is the technical director, Brent Wolf, our news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.